puts my bowl of stew on his chair.
"We'll talk more in the morning," says Obi.
He guides me up and over a couple of steps to a cot in the shadows I hadn't noticed before.
Rafi's guard does the same across the room.
I lie down awkwardly on my side, with my wrists tied behind my back. Obi sits on the cot and ties my ankles together. I'm tempted to make a quip about requiring dinner and a movie before getting so kinky, but I don't. The last thing I need is to start making sex jokes while I'm being held prisoner in a camp full of armed men in a world where there are no laws. He puts a pillow under my head. As he's doing this, he brushes hair out of my face and sweeps it behind my ear. His touch is warm and smooth. I should be scared, but I'm not.
"You'll be all right," he says. "The men will have strict orders to be gentlemanly toward you."
I guess it doesn't take a mind reader to know that I might be worried about that. "Thank you," I say. Obi and his man collect the bowls of stew and leave. The lock clicks behind them.
"Thank you?" asks Rafi.
"Shut up. I'm exhausted. I really need to get some sleep."
"What you need is to decide who's on your side and who's not."
"Will you tell them?" I don't want to get specific in case someone's listening. I hope he understands what I mean. If Rafi and I make it to the Eyrie, he'll have intel on the infant resistance movement. If he tells the other angels and they kill off the movement, I'll be the Judas of my kind. There's a long pause. If he doesn't tell, will he be the Judas of his kind?
"Why did you come here?" he asks, blatantly changing the subject. "Why didn't you run away like we both know you should have?"
"Stupid, huh?"
"Very."
"I just couldn't. I want to ask him why he risked his life to save mine when his people kill us every day. But I can't. Not here. Not now. Not while someone may be listening." We lie in silence, listening to the crickets. After a long time, as they drift away to a numb place, he whispers in the dark,
"They're all asleep except for the guards."
I'm instantly alert. "You have a plan?"
"Sure. Don't you? You're the rescuer."
The moon has moved, and the light coming through the window is dimmer now, but it's still enough for me to see the darker shadow of his form getting up from his cot. He comes over to me and starts untying me.
"How the hell did you do that?"
"When you're storming the Eyrie, remember that ropes won't hold. Angels."
He whispers the last word. I'd forgotten how much stronger he is than a man.
"You mean you could have gotten out all that time? You don't even need me. Why didn't you do it already?"
"What, and miss the fun of rattling their tiny little brains, wondering what happened?"
He swiftly unties me and pulls me to my feet.
"Ah, I get it. You can escape at night, but not during the day. You can't outrun bullets, can you?"
Like most people, my first introduction to angels was through the looping footage of the Archangel Gabriel being shot. I can't help but wonder if the angels would have been less hostile if we hadn't immediately killed their leader. At least, they think he was killed. No one knows for sure, because the body wasn't recovered. Or so they said. The legion of winged men floating behind him dispersed with the panicked crowd, quickly disappearing into the smoky sky. I wonder if Rafi was part of that legion. He arches his brow at me, clearly refusing to discuss the effects of bullets on angels. I give him a smug smile. "You're not as perfect as you look." I walk over to the door and put my ear to it. "Is there anyone else in the building?"
"No."
I try to turn the knob, but it's locked. Rafi sighs.
"I was hoping not to show excessive strength and raise suspicion."
He reaches for the knob, but I stop him. "Well then, good thing I got us covered." I pull a slim lockpick and tension wrench out of my back pocket. The soldier who searched me before tying me up did a fast job. He was looking for guns or bulky knives, not skinny little picks.
"What's that?" I get to work on the lock. It feels good to surprise him with a talent that angels don't have.
Click. Voila!
Talkative, but talented. Who would have thought? I open my mouth to make a smart-ass comeback, then realize I'd only be proving his point. So I stay quiet, just to prove that I can. We sneak out into the hallway and stop at the back door.
Can you hear the guards?
He listens briefly. He points to 11 o'clock and 5 o'clock. We wait.
What's in here?
I ask, pointing at the closed doors.
Who knows? Supplies, maybe?
I start for one of the doors, thinking of venison or even guns. He grabs my arm and shakes his head.
Don't get greedy. If we raid them on our way out, they're less likely to just forget about us. We don't want trouble if we can avoid it.
He's right, of course. Besides, who'd be stupid enough to store guns in the same place as their prisoners? But the thought of venison makes my mouth water. Oh, I should have bargained for that stew while I had the chance. After a minute, Rafi nods, and we slip out into the night. We make a run for it, Rafi and me. My heart flip-flops in my chest as I pump my legs as fast as they will go. The air frosts from my mouth. The smell of soil and trees beckons us toward the forest. The trees rustling in the wind mask the sound of our pounding feet. Rafi could run much faster, but he stays close. The moon disappears behind clouds, and the forest turns dark. I slow to a walk once we're inside the canopy, not wanting to smash into a tree. My breathing is so heavy. I'm afraid the guards will hear it. The adrenaline rush of a run for freedom drains, and I'm back to being scared and tired. I pause, bending over to catch my breath. Rafi puts his hand on my back, urging me to keep going with gentle pressure. He's not even out of breath. He points deeper into the forest. I shake my head and point to the other side of the camp. We need to go around to retrieve his wings. My pack is replaceable. The wings and sword are not. He pauses, then nods. I don't know if he knows what I'm after, but I know that his wings are never far from his mind, the way little Paige is never far from mine. We skirt around the camp, going as deep into the forest as we can without losing sight of the camp. This gets tricky several times, since the moonlight is so dim now, and the camp itself is mostly under canopy. I have to rely more heavily on Rafi's night vision than I like. Even knowing he can see, I can only go so fast without walking into a branch or losing my footing. It takes a long time to navigate the forest in the dark, and even longer to find my stash. Just when I see the tree hiding our goods, I hear the distinctive click of a gun's safety latch behind me. My hands are up in the air before the guy can say, "Freeze!" Chapter 18.
Just for interrupting my night, you're getting latrine duty.
Obi is clearly not an early morning guy, and he doesn't bother to hide that he'd much rather be sleeping than dealing with us.
What do you want with us? I ask. I told you we didn't kill those people.
We're right back where we started. Rafi and I sit tied to our chairs in what I'm starting to think of as our room.
It's now more about what we don't want. We don't want you telling others our numbers, our location, our arsenal. Now that you've seen our camp, we can't let you go until we move.
How long will that be?
A while. Obi shrugs noncommittally. Won't be too long.
We don't have a while.
You'll have as long as we say you have, says Bowden, the guard who caught us.
Or at least that's what the name on his uniform says.
It could, of course, just be a uniform that he took from a dead soldier that already had that name on it.
You'll do everything the resistance movement says, because without it, we'd all be doomed to the hell those angelic motherfu-
Enough, Jim, says Obi.
There's enough weariness in his voice that I'm guessing that good old Jim, and maybe several of the other soldiers, have repeated these exact same lines a million times over with the zeal of the newly converted.
It's true, says Obi. The resistance founders warned us this time would come, told us where to go to survive. galvanized us while the rest of the world was falling apart. We owe the resistance everything. It's our greatest hope of surviving this massacre.
There's more than just this camp, I ask?
It's a network that's all over the world in pockets. We're just becoming aware of the others, trying to organize, trying to coordinate.
Great, says Rafi. Does this mean we have to stay until we forget we ever heard of this resistance movement?
That's the one thing you should spread, says Obi. Knowing about the resistance brings hope and community. We can all use as much of that as possible.
Aren't you worried that if word gets out, that the angels will just destroy it? I ask.
Those pigeons couldn't take us out if they sent their entire chirping flock,
Bowden scoffs. His face is red, and he looks ready for a fight.
Just let him try.
The white-knuckled grip on his rifle is making me nervous. We've had to detain a fair number of people here since the cannibal attack started, says Obi. You're the only ones who managed to make it out. There could be a place for the two of you here. A place with meals and friends. A life with meaning and purpose. Right now we're fractured. They have us eating each other, for God's sake. We can't make a stand if we're bashing each other over the head and killing each other for cans of dog food.
He leans toward us in earnest.
This camp is just the start, and we need everyone to pitch in if we're going to have a chance in hell of taking back our world from the angels. We could use people like you. People with the skills and determination to be humanity's greatest heroes. Bowden snorts.
They can't be that good. They stumbled in a big semicircle around the compound like a couple of dildos. How skilled can they be?
What dildos have to do with it, I have no idea. But he does have a point, in that we did get caught by an idiot. It turns out I don't really get latrine duty. Only Rafi gets that honor. I end up with laundry duty. I'm not sure that's much better. I've never worked so hard in my life. You know, the world has ended when manual labor in America is cheaper and easier than using machines. Men can seriously grime up jeans and other heavy clothes when they're out in the forest. Not to mention unmentionables. I have more than a few ew moments during the day, but I do learn a few things from the other laundry women. After a long stretch of wary silence, the women began to talk. A couple of them have only been at the camp for a few days. They seem surprised and still mistrustful of finding themselves unharmed and unmolested. There's a wariness about the way they keep their voices low and their eyes scanning their surroundings that keeps me from relaxing even when they begin to gossip. While working our butts off, or more accurately, our arms and backs, I learn that Obi is an absolute favorite among the women, and that Bowden and his buddies should be avoided. Obi is in charge of the camp, but not of the entire resistance movement. There's apparently talk, at least among the women, that Obi would be a great worldwide leader of the freedom fighters. I love the idea of a leader destined to lead us out of our dark times. Love the romance of being part of something good and right, led by a group of people fated to be heroes. Only, it isn't my fight. My fight is getting my sister back safe and sound. My fight is keeping my mother out of trouble and shepherding her to a safe place. My fight is feeding and sheltering what remains of my family. Until those battles are permanently won, I don't have the luxury of looking beyond them to the grander picture of wars with gods and romantic heroes. My fight at the moment is struggling to get stains out of sheets that are taller and wider than me by yards. Nothing takes the romance and grandeur out of life more than scrubbing stains out of sheets. One of the women worries over her husband, who she says is playing soldier, even though he's barely moved out of his computer programmer's chair in 20 years. She also frets over her golden retriever, which is in the kennel with the rest of the dogs. It turns out that most of the guard dogs are actually just pets of the people in the camp. They're trying to train them into the mean, vicious guard dogs that chased Rafi, but in reality, they haven't had enough time to train most of them. Besides,
They've spent their whole lives being pampered and played with, and it's apparently not easy to turn them into vicious killers when they'd rather lick you to death or chase squirrels. Dolores assures me that her dog, Checkers, is of the lick-you-to-death variety, and that most of the dogs are in doggy paradise out here in the forest. I nod in more understanding than she realizes. This is the reason the guards are dog-free. It's hard to patrol when your canine partner keeps running off to chase after rodents and barks all night long. Thank goodness for small favors. I casually try to turn the conversation toward what might be gnawing on the refugees on the road. All I get are wary glances and frightened expressions. One woman crosses herself. Talk about a conversation killer. I pick up a grimy pair of pants to dunk in the dingy water, and we go back to working in silence. Although Rafi and I are prisoners here, no one is really guarding us. That is to say, no one is specifically assigned to guard us. Everyone knows we're the newbies, and as such, everyone keeps an eye on us. To avoid notice of Rafi's head injury healing too fast, we managed to put two adhesive bandages at his hairline first thing this morning. We were prepared to say that head injuries bleed a lot, so the injury itself was smaller than it seemed last night. But no one asked. I also took a quick peek at his bandages. There was blood in the shape of wing joints. Dried, but unmistakable. Nothing we could do about that. Rafi digs a ditch by the portable toilets along with other men. He's one of the few still wearing his shirt. There's a dry band around his chest, outlining his bandages, but no one seems to notice. I note the filth on his shirt with a professional eye and hope that someone else ends up having to wash it for him. The sun glints off something shiny on the privacy wall the men are building around the latrine. I'm pondering the perfect regularity of the rectangular boxes they're using to build the wall when I recognize them. Desktop computers. The men are stacking desktop computers and cementing them into a privacy wall. Yep, says Dolores as she sees what I'm looking at. My husband always did call his electronic gadgets bricks when they got phased out. They got phased out, all right. Computers were the height of our technological prowess, and now we're using them as latrine walls, thanks to the angels. I go back to scrubbing a pair of pants on my washboard. Lunch takes several lifetimes to come. I'm about to get Rafi when a honey-haired woman saunters over to him on her long legs. Everything about her walk, her voice, and the tilt of her head invites a man to get a little closer. I change direction and head for the mess hall, pretending not to notice them walking to lunch together. I grab a bowl of venison stew and a heel of bread and scarf them down as fast as I can. Some people grumble around me about having to eat the same old stuff each time, but I've had enough dried noodles and cat food to truly appreciate the taste of fresh meat and canned vegetables. I know from my morning's gossip session that some of the food comes from foraging in the nearby houses, but most of it comes from a warehouse the Resistance keeps hidden. By the looks of things, the Resistance does a good job of providing for their people. As soon as I finish eating, I look for Obi. I've been wanting to plead with him all day to let us go. These people don't seem that bad now that it's daylight, and maybe they'll sympathize with my urgent need to rescue my sister. Of course, I can't keep Rafi from telling the enemy about this camp, but there's no reason he'll want to tell anyone until we reach the Eyrie, and maybe by then, the camp will have moved. It's a lame justification, but it'll have to do. I find Obi surrounded by men who are gingerly moving crates from the storage closets I almost peeked into last night. There are two men carefully loading each crate onto a truck. When one loses his grip on a corner, everyone freezes. For a few heartbeats, they all stare at the man who lost his grip. I can almost smell their fear. They all exchange glances as if confirming that they're all still here. Then they continue their sideways crab walking toward the truck. I guess the things stored in that room had more bang than venison and guns. I try to go talk to Obi, but a camouflaged chest blocks my way. When I look up, the guard who caught us last night, Bowden, glares down at me.
Get back to your washing, woman.
Are you kidding me? What century are you from?
This century. This is the new reality, sweet cheeks. Accept it before I cram it down your throat.
His eyes drop meaningfully to my mouth.
Deep and hard.
I can practically smell the lust and violence on him. A needle of fear spikes in my chest. I need to talk to Obi.
Yeah, you and every other chicken camp. I got your Obi right here.
He grabs himself between his legs and sort of shakes it up and down like he is shaking hands with his dick. Then he leans his face down close to mine and wiggles his tongue in an obscene gesture so close to me that I can feel his spittle. That needle of fear punctures my lungs, and all the air seems to go out of me. But the anger that swamps it is a tsunami taking over every cell in my body. Here is the embodiment of the very thing that had me crawling from car to car, hiding and freezing at the slightest sound, scampering in the shadows like an animal, desperate with worry that someone like him will catch me, my sister, my mother. Here is the bigger, stronger attitude that had the nerve to steal my sister, a helpless, sweet little girl. Here is the thing literally blocking me from rescuing her.
What did you just say to me?
The girl who used to be civilized and polite just had to give him a second chance.
I said.
I slam the heel of my hand into his nose. I don't just do it with my arm. The force comes all the way from my hips as I launch my whole body into the strike. I feel the nose smash under my onslaught. Even better, he'd started to do that obscene gesture with his tongue again, and it smashes between his teeth as his head whiplashes back, spraying blood from his bit tongue. Sure, I'm pissed off, but my actions are not entirely without thought. I might regularly open my mouth without thinking, but I never start a fight without consulting my brain. For this one, I figured I'd win as soon as I made the first move. Intimidation tactics like his are common among bullies. The smaller, weaker opponent is supposed to cringe and back off. My quick calculation went something like this. He's a foot taller and wider than me, a trained soldier, and I'm a girl. If I had been a man, people might let us fight it out. But people tend to believe that when a girl hits a big guy with a gun looming over her, it must be in self-defense. With all these macho men milling about, I give it about 10 seconds before someone breaks up our fight. So, without much harm, I'd win the battle because, one, I'd get Obi's attention, which was what I was trying to do in the first place. Two, I'd humiliate Knucklebrain by showing everybody what kind of a girl-intimidating bully he is. And three, I'd make my point that I'm not easy pickings. What I don't count on is how much damage Bowden can do in 10 seconds. He spends a few seconds staring at me in shock and gathering his fury. Then he slams an SUV of a punch across my jaw. Then he hurls his body into me. I land on my back, trying desperately to catch my breath through the talons of pain gripping my lungs and face. By the time he sits on top of me, I figure I have about 2 seconds left. Maybe a really fast, chivalrous soldier out there would beat my estimate. Maybe Rafi is already leaping to get this gorilla off me. Bowden grabs the neck of my sweatshirt with one fist and cocks the other for another smash. Okay, I just need to survive this punch. Then someone is bound to reach us. I grab the pinky of the hand on my sweatshirt and give it the hardest twist I can, flipping it all the way over. It's a little-known fact that where the pinky goes, so goes the hand, wrist, arm, and body. Otherwise, something breaks along the way. He jerks with it, gritting his teeth and twisting his body to follow the pinky. That's when I catch a glimpse of the people around us. I was beginning to think this camp had the slowest soldiers in history. But I was wrong. A surprising number of people made it to the fight in record time. The only problem is that they're acting like kids in a schoolyard, running to watch the fight, rather than to break it up. My surprise costs me. Bowden jams his elbow into my right breast.
The intense pain just about kills me. I curl as best I can with 200 pounds of muscle on top of me, but that doesn't protect me from the bitch slap he whips across my face. Now he's adding insult to injury, because if I had been a man, he would have hit me with a closed fist. Great. If he just slaps me around and I still get beaten, then I'll only prove that I'm someone everyone can push around. Where's Rafi when I need him? Out of the corner of my eye, I see him among a blur of faces, his expression utterly grim. He writes something down on money, then passes it to a guy who's collecting bills from everyone around him. It dawns on me what they're doing. They're taking bets. Worse, the few who are cheering for me aren't cheering for me to win. They're screaming for me to last just one more minute. Apparently, no one's even betting that I'll win, only on how long I'll last. So much for chivalry. Chapter 19. While I'm taking in the scene, I block two more hits with Bowden sitting on top of me. My forearms are taking a beating, and my bruises are getting bruises. With no rescue in sight, it's time to get serious about the fight. I lift my butt and legs off the ground like a gymnast, and wrap my legs around Bowden's thick neck, hooking my ankles at his throat. I rock my body forward, jerking my legs down. Bowden's eyes widen as he's yanked backward. Entwined, we swing like a rocking chair. He lands on his back, legs spread around my waist. I'm suddenly sitting upright with my ankles wrapped around his throat. The instant we land, I slam my fists into his groin. Now it's his turn to curl. The cheering crowd instantly mutes. The only noise I hear is Bowden's groaning. Sounds like he's having trouble breathing. Just to make sure he stays that way, I jump up and kick him in the face. I kick him so hard his body spins halfway on the dirt. I wind up for another kick, this time to the stomach. When you're small enough to have to look up at everyone around you, there's no such thing as a dirty fight. That's a new motto for me. I think I'll keep it. Before I can complete my kick, someone grabs me around my ribs, pinning my arms. My heart thunders from the adrenaline, and I'm practically panting in my need for blood. I kick and scream at whoever holds me. "Easy. Easy," says Obi. "That's enough." His voice is like velvet brushing against my ears, his arms like steel bands across my ribs. "Shh. Relax. It's over. You won." He guides me out of the circle and through the crowd as he soothes me, his arms never relaxing their hold. I glare my most condemning glare at Rafi as I catch his eye. I could have been beaten to a pulp, and all he would have done was lose a bet. He still looks grim, his muscles taut, his face pale as though all the blood has drained from him.
"Where are my winnings?" asks Rafi.
I realize he's not talking to me, even though he's still looking at me. It's as if he wants to make sure I hear it along with everyone else.
"You didn't win," says a guy near him.
He sounds gleeful. He's the one who collected all the bets.
"What do you mean?"
"My bet was the closest to what happened," growls Rafi.
His hands are fisted as he turns to the guy, and he looks ready for a fight himself.
"Hey, buddy, you didn't bet she'd win. Close doesn't count."
Their voices drift into the wind as Obi practically drags me to the mess hall. I don't know which is worse, that Rafi didn't jump in to defend me, or that he bet that I would lose. The mess hall is a big, open cabin with rows of fold-up tables and chairs. I'm guessing it would take less than half an hour to fold it all up for moving. From everything I've seen, the whole camp is designed to be packed up and moved in less than an hour. The place is deserted, even though there are half-eaten food trays on the tables. I guess a fight is a not-to-be-missed event around here. Obi's grip on me relaxes once I stop struggling. He guides me to a table closest to the kitchen in the back.
"Sit. I'll be right back."
I sit on a metal folding chair, trembling with the adrenaline crash. He heads back into the kitchen area. I take deep breaths, calming down and getting a hold of myself, until he comes back with a first aid kit and a bag of frozen peas. He hands me the peas.
"Put this on your jaw.
It'll help with the swelling. I take the bag, staring at the familiar photo of green peas, before gingerly pressing it to my tender jaw. The fact that they have the power to keep food frozen impresses me more than the rest of the camp combined. There's something awe-inspiring about the ability to maintain some aspects of civilization when the rest of the world is sinking into a dark age. Obi cleans the blood and dirt off my scrapes. They're mostly that. Scrapes. Your camp sucks, I say. The peas are numbing my jaw, and my words come out slurred.
Sorry about that.
He rubs antibiotic ointment onto the scrapes on my hands.
There's so much tension and jittery energy that we've had to accommodate our people's need to blow off steam. The trick is to let them do it under controlled conditions.
You call what happened out there a controlled condition?
A half-smile brightens his face. I'm sure Bowden didn't think so.
He rubs more ointment on my scraped knuckles. One of the concessions we made is that if a fight breaks out, no one interferes until there's a clear winner, or it becomes life-threatening. We just let people take bets on the outcome. It blows off steam for both the fighters and the spectators.
So much for the power to maintain a piece of civilization.
Also, he says, it helps keep the number of fights down when the entire camp is taking bets on the outcome. People take fights seriously when there's no one to rescue you, and the whole camp is watching your every move.
So, everyone knew this rule but me? That no one is allowed to interfere?
Had Rafi known it? Not that it should have stopped him.
People can jump in if they want, but that invites someone else to jump in for the other side to keep it a fair fight. The betters wouldn't like it if it suddenly turned one-sided.
So much for making excuses for Rafi. He could have jumped in. We just would have had to fight someone else, too. Nothing we haven't done before.
Sorry no one explained the rules of the playground to you.
He bandages my bleeding elbow.
It's just that we haven't had a female get into a fight before.
He shrugs.
We just didn't expect it.
I guess this means you lost your bet. He grins sourly.
I only make big bets that involve lives and the future of humanity.
His shoulders slump, as though the invisible weight on them is too much.
Speaking of which, you handled yourself well out there. Better than anyone expected. We could really use someone like you.
There are situations that a girl like you could handle better than a platoon of men. His grin turns boyish.
Assuming you don't clock an angel for pissing you off.
That's a big assumption.
We can work on that.
He gets up.
Think about it.
Actually, I was trying to get to you when that gorilla got in my way. The angels have taken my sister. You need to let me go so I can find her. I swear I won't tell anybody about you, your location, anything. Just please let me go.
I'm sorry about your sister, but I can't jeopardize everyone here based on your word.
Join us, and we'll help you get her back.
It'll be too late by the time you can mobilize your men. She's 7 years old and wheelchair-bound.
I can barely get the words out through the lump in my throat. I can't actually say what we both know, that it might already be too late.
He shakes his head, looking genuinely sympathetic. I'm sorry. Everyone here has had to bury someone they love. Join us, and we'll make those bastards pay.
I don't intend to bury her. She's not dead. I grind out the words.
I'm going to find her, and get her out.
Of course. I didn't mean to imply that she was. He had, and we both know it. But I pretend to believe his pretty words. As I've heard other people's mothers tell their daughters, politeness is its own reward.
We'll be moving soon, and you can go then if you still want to leave us.
I hope you won't.
When is soon? I can't disclose that information. All I can say is that we have something major in the works. You should be a part of it. For your sister. For humanity. For all of us.
He's good. I feel like standing up and saluting him while humming the national anthem. But I don't think he'd appreciate that. I am, of course, rooting for the humans. But I already have more responsibilities than I can handle. I just want to be an ordinary girl living an ordinary life. My biggest concern in life should be what dress to wear to the prom, not how to escape a paramilitary camp to rescue my sister from cruel angels, and certainly not whether to join a resistance army to beat back an invasion to save humanity. I know my limits, and that goes way beyond them. So I just nod. He can make of that what he will. I hadn't really expected him to let me go, but I had to try. As soon as he walks out the door, the lunch crowd shuffles back in. It must be understood, either implicitly or explicitly, that when Obi talks to one of the fighters, everyone gives them privacy. Interesting that he took me to the mess hall during lunch, making everyone wait until we were finished. He sent a clear message to everyone in the camp that I am someone he has noticed. I get up to leave with my chin up. I avoid looking into any faces so I won't have to talk to anyone. I walk with my bag of peas down so as to not bring attention to my injuries, as if people are likely to forget I'm the one who was fighting. If Rafi is in the lunch crowd, I don't see him. Just as well. I hope he lost his argument with the bookie. He deserves to lose that bet. I'm barely out and walking between the buildings on my way to the laundry area when two red-headed guys step out from behind a building. If they didn't have matching boy-next-door smiles, I would have thought they were ambushing me. They're identical twins. Both look scrappy and strung out in their dirty civilian clothes, but that's not unusual these days. No doubt I look just as scrappy and strung out. They're barely out of their teens, tall and skinny, with mischievous eyes.
"Great job out there, champ," says the first guy.
"Oh, man, you really put old Jimmy Bowden in his place," says the second one.
He's practically beaming.
"Couldn't have happened to a better man."
I stand there nodding. I keep a polite grin on my face while still holding the frozen peas to my jaw.
"I'm Tweedledee," says one.
"I'm Tweedledum," says the other. "Most people call us Deedum for short, since they can't tell us apart."
"You're joking, right?" They shake their heads in unison, with identical friendly smiles. They look more like a couple of underfed scarecrows than the chubby Tweedledee and Tweedledum I remember from childhood. "Why would you call yourselves that?" Dee shrugs.
"New world, new names. We were going to be Gog and Magog.
Those were our online names," says Dum.
"But why go all doom and gloom?" asks Dee.
"Used to be fun being Gog and Magog when the world was Tiffany Twisted and suburban simple," says Dum. "But now,
not so much," says Dee.
"Death and destruction are so passé. So mainstream. So in with the popular crowd. We'd rather be Tweedledee and Tweedledum."
I nod. Because what other response is there? "I'm Penryn. I'm named after an exit off Interstate 80.
"Nice."
They nod as if to say they understand what it's like to have parents like that.
"Everyone's talking about you," says Dum.
Not sure I like that. That whole fight thing didn't really go off the way I had planned. Then again, nothing in my life has gone the way I had planned. "Great. If you don't mind, I'm going to go hide now." I tip my bag of frozen peas at them, like a hat, as I try to step between them.
"Wait," says Dee.
He lowers his voice to a dramatic whisper.
"We have a business proposition for you."
I pause and politely wait. Unless their proposition includes getting me out of here, there is nothing they can say to get me interested in any kind of business idea. But since they aren't moving out of my way, I don't have much of a choice but to listen.
"The crowd loved you," says Dum.
"How about a repeat performance?" asks Dee. "Say for a 30% take of the winnings?"
"What are you talking about? Why would I risk my life for a measly 30% of the winnings? Besides, money doesn't buy you anything anymore."
"Oh, it's not money," says Dum.
We just use money as a shortcut for the relative value of the bet.
His face becomes animated, like he's genuinely fascinated by the economics of post-apocalyptic gambling.
You put your name and the bet you're making on, say, a $5 bill, and that just tells the bookie that you're willing to bet something of greater value than a dollar bill, but less than a $10 bill. It's the bookie who decides who gets what and who gives what. You know, like, maybe someone loses a quarter of his rations and gets extra chores for a week. Or if he wins, then he gets someone else's rations to add to his, and someone else scrubs the toilet for him for a week. Get it?
Got it. And the answer's still no. Besides, there's no guarantee I'll win.
No? Dee gives me an over-the-top used car salesman smile. We're looking for a guarantee that you'll lose.
I burst out laughing. You want me to throw a fight?
Shh!
Dee looks around dramatically. We're standing in the shadows between two buildings, and no one seems to notice us.
It'll be great, says Dumb. His eyes shine with mischief. After what you did to Bowden, the odds will be so far in your favor when you fight Anita.
You want me to fight a girl? I cross my arms. You just want to see a cat fight, don't you?
It's not just for us, says Dee defensively. It'll be a gift to the whole camp.
Yeah, says Dumb. Who needs television when you've got all that water and laundry suds?
Dream on. I shove through them.
We'll help you get out, says Dee in a sing-song cadence.
I stop. My brain runs through half a dozen scenarios based on what he just said.
We can get the keys to your cell.
We can distract the guards.
We can make sure no one checks on you until morning.
One fight. That's all we ask.
I turn to look at them. Why would you risk treason for a mud fight?
You have no idea how much I'd risk for an honest-to-God mud fight between two hot women, says Dee.
It's not really treason anyway, says Dumb. Obi's gonna let you go. It's just a matter of timing. We're not here to keep human prisoners. He's overemphasizing your risk to us.
Why? I ask.
Because he wants to recruit you and that guy you came with. Obi's an only child, and he doesn't understand, says Dee. He thinks keeping you around for a few days will get you to change your mind about leaving us.
But we know better. A few days of singing patriotic songs ain't going to convince you to abandon your sister, says Dumb.
Got that right, brother, says Dee.
They bump fists.
Damn straight.
I look at them. They really do understand. They'd never leave each other behind. Maybe I have genuine allies. Do I really have to do this silly fight to get your help?
Oh, yeah, says Dee. No question.
They both grin at me like mischievous little boys. How do you know all this stuff? About my sister? What Obi's thinking?
It's our job, says Dumb. Some people call us D-Dumb. Other people call us spy masters.
He wiggles his eyebrows up and down dramatically. Okay, spy master D-Dumb. What did my friend bet on the fight? It doesn't matter, of course, but I still want to know.
Interesting.
Dee arches his brow in a knowing fashion.
Of all the things you could have asked when you found out we deal in information, you pick that one.
My cheeks warm despite the frozen peas on my jaw. I try not to look like I wish I could take back my question. What are you, in kindergarten? Just tell me already.
He bet that you'd last in the ring for at least 7 minutes.
Dumb rubs his freckled cheek.
We all thought he was crazy.
7 minutes is a long, long time to get hammered by giant fists.
Not crazy enough, says Dee.
His smile is so boyish and pre-disaster that it's almost possible to forget we live in a world gone mad.
He should have bet that you'd win. He would have raked it in. Man, the odds were so far against you. I bet he could take down Bowden in 2 minutes, says Dumb. That guy's got badass written all over him. 90 seconds flat, says D.
I've seen Rafi fight. My bet would be on 10 seconds, assuming Bowden didn't have a rifle like he did the night he caught us. But I don't say that. Doesn't make me feel any better that he didn't jump in to play the hero. Get us out tonight, and you've got a deal, I say.
Tonight's awfully short notice, says D.
Maybe if you could promise you'll rip Anita's shirt off.
Dumb gives me his little boy smile. Don't push your luck. D holds up a slim leather case and dangles it like bait.
How about a bonus for ripping her shirt off?
My hands fly to my pants pocket, where my lock-picking set should be. My pocket is flat and empty.
Hey, that's mine!
I make a grab for it, but it disappears from Dee's hand. I hadn't seen him move.
How did you do that?
Now you see it, says Dumb, waving the case.
How it got from Dee to Dumb, I have no idea. They're standing next to each other, but still, I should have seen something. Then it's gone again.
Now you don't.
Give it back now, you thieving bastards, or the whole thing's off.
Dumb gives Dee a sad clown face. Dee arches his brow in a comic expression.
Fine, Dee sighs.
He hands me back my lock-picking set. This time, I was watching for it, but I still didn't see it moving from Dumb to Dee.
Tonight it is.
Dee-Dum flash identical grins at me. I shake my head and stomp off before they can steal any more of my things. Chapter 20. My back snaps, crackles, and pops as I try to stand straight. It's dusk and my workday is almost over. I put my hand on the small of my back, my body craning slowly to straighten like an ancient crone. My hands, after only one day of scrubbing clothes in the wash tub, are swollen and red. I've heard of dry, cracked hands, but never really knew what that meant until now. After only a few minutes of being out of the water, my palm has cracks that look like someone took a razor blade and sliced the skin. It's freaky to see your hand all cut up, looking too dry to even bleed. When the other laundry judges offered me a pair of yellow rubber gloves this morning, I turned them down, thinking only prissy old people used those. They gave me such know-it-all looks that my pride wouldn't let me ask for them at lunch. Now, I'm beginning to consider getting up close and personal with the one humble bone in my body and asking for the gloves. Good thing I don't plan on having to do this again tomorrow. I look around, stretching my arms, wondering when this Anita person is going to attack me. I'll be really pissed if she waits until my workday is over. What's the point of getting into a catfight if you can't even weasel out of an hour of hard labor? I take my time stretching. I reach above my head and arch my back as far as it'll go. My neck hurts. My back hurts. My arms and hands hurt. My legs and feet hurt. Even my eyeballs hurt. My muscles are either screaming from hours of repetitive motion or stiff from hours of being held still. At this rate, I won't have to throw the fight. I'll lose it honestly. I pretend not to watch the latrine duty men walking toward us as I stretch my legs. There are about 10 of them with Rafi hanging in the back of the group. When they are a few steps away, they start stripping off their filthy clothes. Grimy shirts, pants, and socks get tossed into the laundry pile. Some get tossed into the trash pile. Rafi dug the ditch instead of working on the truly toxic part of the latrines, but not everyone was that lucky. The only things they leave on are their boxer shorts. I try very hard not to look at Rafi, as I realize he'll be expected to take his shirt off. He might be able to explain away the bandages under his shirt, but there's no way he can explain away the bloodstains exactly where wings would have been. I stretch my arms above my head, trying not to look scared. I hold my breath, hoping the men will move along and not notice Rafi lagging behind. but instead of moving into the buildings for a shower, they grab the hose we've been using to fill our tubs. They line up to hose each other off. I could kick myself for not anticipating this. Of course they'll hose off first. Who would want latrine workers to walk straight into the shared showers?
I steal a glance at Rafi. He's keeping his cool, but I can tell by how slowly he's unbuttoning his shirt that he didn't see this coming either. He must have figured he could slip away once they got into the building, since the showers couldn't take everyone at the same time. But there is no good excuse to drift away from this part of the routine, and no way to do it without being noticed.
Rafi finishes unbuttoning his shirt, and instead of taking it off, he slowly starts unbuttoning his pants. Everyone around him is already stripped, and he's starting to look conspicuous. Just when I'm wondering if we should make a blatant run for it, the solution to our problem saunters toward us on long, shapely legs. The woman who walked with Rafi to lunch tosses her honey hair as she smiles up at him. Didum walk by as if on cue.
"Oh, hi, Anita," they both say with casual surprise.
Their voices are slightly raised, as if to make sure I hear them. Anita glares at them, as if they'd just hawked and spat. I've seen that look a million times in the hallways given by a popular girl to a band geek when he gets too familiar in front of her clique. She turns back to Rafi, her face melting into a radiant smile. She puts her hand on his arm as he's about to take off his pants. And that's all the excuse I need. I grab a sudsy shirt out of the gray water and throw it at her. It makes a plopping noise when it lands on her face, wrapping around her hair. Her perfect hair clumps into a stringy mass, and her mascara smears as the cloth slides wetly down her blouse. She emits a high-pitched squeal that turns every head within earshot.
"Oh, I'm sorry," I say in a sugary voice.
"Did you not like that? I thought that's what you wanted. I mean, why else would you be getting all grabby with my man?"
The small crowd around us grows by the second.
"Oh yeah, baby. Step right up. Come see the freak show."
Rafi fades into the growing crowd, discreetly buttoning up his shirt. And I thought he looked grim at my last fight. Anita's enormous eyes look up helplessly at Rafi. She looks like a distressed kitten, bewildered and hurt.
Poor thing. I have second thoughts about whether I can do this.
Then she looks at me. It's amazing how quickly her face can change, depending on who she's looking at. She looks spitting mad. As she stalks toward me, anger turns into rage. It's impressive how vicious a pretty woman can look when she sets her mind to it. Either she's one hell of an actress, or Didam had a double agenda when they set this up. I'll bet she doesn't even know about the fight. Why share the profits when you can get revenge instead? I'm sure this wasn't the first time Anita has snubbed Didam. Not that I believe for a second that their feelings were hurt.
You think anything you do would get a guy like him to look at you twice? Anita flings the wet shirt back at me.
You'd be lucky to get a one-legged grandpa to be interested in you.
Okay. Turns out, I can do this.
I lean a little to make sure the shirt hits me. Then, we go at it in all our feminine glory. Hair pulling, face slapping, shirt ripping, nail scratching. We squeal like cheerleaders who fell into a mud pit. As we stumble around in our drunken dance, we bump into a wash basin. It comes crashing down, spraying the whole area with water. She trips over it while clinging to me, and we come tumbling down. Our bodies contort around each other as we roll in the mud around the wash basins. It's hard to look dignified when your head is being pulled down to your shoulder by your hair. It's embarrassing. I do my best to look as though I'm really fighting. The crowd goes wild with their cheering and clapping. I catch a glimpse of Didam as we roll. They're practically hopping with glee. Just how does somebody lose a fight like this? Should I break down crying?
land in the mud face down and let her scratch me a few times while I curl into a ball? I'm at a complete loss as how to tap out of this fight. All thoughts of the fight are shattered by a gunshot. It comes from somewhere past the crowd, but it's close enough to make everyone freeze in silence. Two more shots go off in rapid succession. Then a scream echoes through the woods. A very human, very terrified scream. Chapter 21. The wind rustles through the treetops. My blood pounds in my ears. For a few heartbeats, everyone stares into the twilight with eyes wide as if waiting for a nightmare to come to life. Then, as though a command had been given, chaos bursts through the crowd. Soldiers run to the trees in the direction of the scream, gripping their guns and rifles. Everyone starts talking, some crying. Some rush one way, others rush another. It's a crush of noise and confusion bordering on panic. Like the dogs, these people aren't as well trained as Obi would like. Anita climbs off me, the whites of her eyes showing all around her irises. She takes off, running after the biggest crowd, which is stampeding into the mess hall. I get up, torn between wanting to see what's happening and wanting to hide in the relative safety of numbers. Rafi is suddenly beside me, whispering,
"Where are the wings?"
"What?"
"Where did you hide them?"
"In a tree." He sighs, obviously trying to be patient.
"Can you tell me?"
I point in the direction of the scream, where the last of the soldiers disappear.
"Can you tell me how to find it? Or do you need to show me?"
"I'd have to show you."
"Then let's go."
"Now?"
"Can you think of a better time?"
I glance around. Everyone is still scrambling to grab gear and run into a building. No one gives us a second glance. No one would notice if we disappeared during the chaos. Of course, there's whatever it is that's causing the panic. My thoughts must show in my face because Rafi says,
"Either tell me or show me. It has to be now."
Twilight is sliding fast into full dark around us. My skin prickles at the thought of wandering through the forest in the dark with whatever it was that caused an armed soldier to scream like that. But I can't let Rafi run without me. I nod. We slip into the darkening shadows for the closest path to the forest. We half tiptoe, half run through the woods. Gunshots fire in rapid, overlapping succession. Several guns fire simultaneously in the woods. Maybe this isn't the best idea. As if I'm not freaked out enough, screams echo through the oncoming night. By the time we run across the camp and reach the hiding tree area, the woods are quiet. Not a single rustle. No birds or squirrels disturb the silence. The light is fading fast, but there's enough to see the carnage. About a dozen soldiers had run toward the scream. Now, there are only 5 still standing. The rest lie scattered on the ground like broken dolls tossed by an angry child. And like broken dolls, there are body parts missing. An arm, a leg, a head. The ripped joints are ragged and gory. Blood splatters everything. The trees, the dirt, the soldiers. The dimming light has leached the color out of it, making it look like oil dripping off the branches. The remaining soldiers stand in a circle, with their rifles pointing outward. I'm puzzled by the angle of their rifles. They don't point straight out or up, the way they would for an enemy on foot or in the air. Nor do they point to the ground, the way they would if they weren't about to fire. Instead, they point midway down as if aiming at something that's only as high as their waist. Mountain lion? There are mountain lions in these hills, although it's rare to see one. But mountain lions don't cause this kind of slaughter. Maybe wild dogs? But again, the slaughter doesn't look natural. It looks like a vicious, murderous attack rather than a hunt for food or a defensive fight. The memory pops into my head of Rafi mentioning the possibility of kids attacking that family on the street. I dismiss that thought as soon as it comes.
These armed soldiers would never be this scared of a gang of kids, no matter how feral. Everything about the survivors looks freaky spooked, as though the only thing containing their panic is their paralyzing fear. Their white-knuckled grips on their rifles, the way they hold their elbows tight near their bodies as if to keep their arms from shaking, the way they move shoulder to shoulder like a school of fish clustering near a predator. Nothing natural could cause this kind of fear. It goes beyond a fear of physical harm and into the realm of mental and spiritual. Like the fear of losing your sanity, of losing your soul. My skin prickles watching the soldiers. Fear is contagious. Maybe it's something that's evolved from our primeval days, when your survival odds were better if you picked up on your buddy's fear without wasting time to discuss it. Or maybe I'm sensing something directly. Something horrifying that my reptile brain recognizes. My stomach churns and tries to reject its contents. I swallow it back, ignoring the acid burn on the back of my throat. We huddle out of sight behind a large tree. I glance at Rafi, crouched beside me. He is looking at everything but the soldiers, as if they are the one thing in the forest we don't need to worry about. I'd feel better if he didn't look so uneasy. What spooks an angel who's stronger, faster, and has keener senses than man? The soldiers shift. The shape of their circle changes to a teardrop. The men ooze nervousness as they back slowly toward the camp. Whatever had attacked them seems to be gone. Or at least, the soldiers seem to think so. My instincts aren't convinced. I guess not all the soldiers are convinced either, because they look so freaked out that the slightest sound might be enough for them to open fire, spraying bullets every which way into the dark. The temperature is plummeting, and my wet t-shirt clings to me like a sheet of ice. But sweat trickles down my temples anyway, and pools greasily in my armpits. Watching the soldiers leave is like watching the basement door close, shutting out the only light in the house, and leaving me alone in the monster-filled darkness. Every muscle in my body screams to run after the soldiers. Every instinct is frantic not to be the lone guppy separated from its school. I look at Rafi, hoping for some kind of reassurance. He's on full alert, his body tense, his eyes searching the darkening forest, his ears perked as though listening in stereo.
"Where is it?"
His whisper is so low, I'm reading his lips almost as much as hearing his words. At first, I assume he's talking about the monster that could do such damage. But before I can ask how should I know, I realize he's asking where the wings are hidden. I point beyond where the soldiers had been standing. He silently runs to the other side of the circle of destruction, ignoring the carnage. I tiptoe run after him, desperate not to be left behind in the woods. I have a hard time ignoring the body parts. There aren't enough bodies and parts to account for all the missing men. Hopefully some of them ran off, and that's the reason there are fewer of them than there should be. I slip on the blood in the middle of the carnage, but manage to regain my footing before I fall. The thought of falling face first on a pile of human intestines is enough to keep me moving to reach the other side. Rafi stands in the midst of the trees, trying to find one with a hollow. It takes a few minutes before we spot it. When he pulls out the blanket-wrapped bundle of his wings, the tension leaches out of him, and he hunches his shoulders and head protectively around the bundle. He looks at me, and there is enough light for me to see him mouth the words, "Thank you." It seems to be our fate to continually pass our debt back and forth. I wonder how long it takes before it's too late to reattach the wings to his back. If it was a human body part, it would be past the expiration date already. But who knows about angels? And even if the angel surgeons or magicians or whatever manage to reattach them, I wonder if they'll be usable or just decorative, the way a glass eye is just so that people can look at your face without cringing. A cold wind teases my hair,
making it brush against the back of my neck like icy fingers. The forest is a mass of shifting shadows. The whipping of the leaves sounds like a thousand snakes hissing above me. I look up just to make sure there aren't really snakes up there. All I see are redwoods looming under the blackening sky. Rafi touches my arm. I practically jump out of my skull, but manage to stay quiet. He hands me my pack. He keeps the wings and the sword. He nods in the direction of the camp and walks toward it, following the soldiers. I don't understand why he wants to head back to camp when we should be running the other way. But the forest has me so creeped out that I'm not inclined to linger alone, nor am I eager to break our silence. I slip on my pack and follow. I stick to Rafi as close as I can manage without having to explain why I'm hugging his back. We reach the edge of the woods. The camp is quiet under the mottled moon shadow beneath the camp's canopy. No lights glow from the windows, although if I look hard enough, I can catch a glimpse of metal glinting in the moonlight in some of the windows. I wonder how many rifles they have trained through the glass, seeking targets. I don't envy Obi having to maintain order in those buildings. I'm sure panic in a confined space can be pretty ugly. Rafi leans over to me and whispers so low I can barely hear him.
I'll watch to make sure you get safely into the building. Go.
I blink stupidly at him, trying to make sense of what he is saying. But what about you? He shakes his head. It seems reluctant, for all the good that will do me.
You're safer in there, and you're safer without me. If you're still set on finding your sister, head for San Francisco. You'll find the Airy there.
He's leaving me. Leaving me at Obi's camp while he goes on to the Airy. No.
I need you, I almost blurt out.
I saved you. You owe me.
Listen to me. You are safer on your own than with me. This is no accident. This sort of ending...
He gestures toward the massacre.
It happens too often to my companions.
He runs his hand through his hair.
It's been so long since I had someone to watch my back. I'd fooled myself into believing things could be different. Do you understand?
No. It is more of a rejection of what he's telling me than an answer to his question. He stares into my eyes with an intense look. I hold my breath. I swear he's memorizing me, as though his mental camera is firing, capturing me in this moment. He even inhales deeply, as though filling up on my scent. But the moment passes when he looks away and leaves me wondering if I imagined it. Then he turns and melts into the darkness. By the time I take a step, his form has completely merged with the darker shadows. I want to call out to him, but I don't dare make that kind of noise. Darkness closes around me. My heart hammers in my chest, telling me to run, run, run. I can't believe he left me. Alone in the dark, with a demon monster. I clench my fists, digging my nails into my skin to help me focus. No time to feel sorry for myself. I've got to concentrate if I'm going to survive long enough to rescue Paige. The safest place to spend the night is the camp. But if I run to the camp, they won't let me go until they're ready to move. That could be days. Weeks. Paige doesn't have weeks. Whatever it is they're doing to her, they're doing it right now. I've already wasted too much time. On the other hand, what are my options? Run through the forest? In the dark? Alone? With a monster that tore apart half a dozen armed men? I frantically beat my brain for a third option. I come up with nothing. I've hesitated long enough. Being found by the monster as I stand frozen in indecision is the stupidest way to die that I can think of. Rock or hard place? I steel myself to ignore the creepy sensation crawling up my back. I take a deep breath and let it out slowly, hoping to calm myself. It doesn't work. I turn away from camp and plunge into the forest. Chapter 22. I can't help but look to see if there's anything I need to worry about sneaking up behind me. Not that a monster capable of tearing apart armed soldiers would bother sneaking. I wonder why we didn't evolve with eyes in the back of our heads. The farther I walk into the woods, the tighter the darkness closes in on me. I tell myself that this isn't really suicide. The woods are full of living creatures. Squirrels, birds, deer, rabbits. And the monster can't kill them all. So my chances of being among the majority of living things in the forest that will survive tonight are pretty good. Right? I move through the dark woods by instinct, hoping I'm heading north. Within a short time, I begin to have serious doubts about which direction I'm moving. I read somewhere that when lost and left to their own devices, people tend to walk in large circles. What if I'm walking the wrong way? Doubts erode my reason, and I can feel the panic bubbling in my chest. I give myself a mental slap. This is not the time to freak out. I promise I'll let myself panic when I'm safe and sound, hidden in a nice house with a stocked kitchen with Paige and Mom. Yeah, right. The thought brings a twitch to my lips, as if I might grin. Maybe I really am losing it. I see menace behind every rustle and shifting shadow, behind every bird taking flight and squirrel scrambling on a branch. After what feels like hours of trekking through the woods in the dark, one of the shadows shifts from a tree, like so many wind-blown branches. Only, this one keeps moving away from the tree. It separates itself from the larger mass of shadows, then merges into another, greater darkness. I freeze. It could have been a deer, but the shadow legs didn't move right. It might have been something on 2 feet. Or more accurately, several somethings on 2 feet. My hunch proves right when the shadows fan out, surrounding me. I hate being right all the time. So, what stands on 2 legs, is 3 or 4 feet tall, and growls like a pack of dogs? It's hard to think of much other than those bodies scattered about the forest floor with missing parts. A shadow rushes toward me, so fast it looks like a dark blur. Something bumps into my arm. I step back, but whatever it was is already long gone. The other shadows shift. Some dart forward and back, looking like shadows beginning to boil. Something bumps my other arm before I register that another shadow has darted out. I stagger back. Our neighbor Justin used to have a set of needle-like piranha teeth displayed on his mantle. He told us once that the carnivorous and sometimes cannibalistic fish are actually quite shy and usually bump their prey before attacking, gaining confidence as their schoolmates do the same. This feels eerily like his description. The chorus of growling rises. It sounds like a mix of animal growls and disturbingly human grunting. Another hit. This time, a sharp pain stabs up from my thigh, like I've been sliced by razors. I shiver as a warm pool spreads around the pain. Then I get bumped twice more in rapid succession. Is the blood whipping them into a frenzy? Another hits my wrist. I cry out this time as soon as I feel it. This one isn't just a quick slice. It's a lingering one. If a flashing shadow can be said to linger. The burning hits me a second after I realize I've been... bitten? I'm sure I'd be less scared if I could just see what they look like. There's something particularly terrifying about not being able to see the things attacking you. My panting is so loud now that I might as well be screaming. Chapter 23. I catch motion out of the corner of my eye. I don't even have time to brace for another hit before Rafi stands before me. His muscles are tense, holding his sword as he faces the boiling shadows. I hadn't even heard the rustle of leaves. One second he's not there, the next he is.
Run, Penryn!
I don't need another invitation. I run. But I don't run far, which is probably not my smartest move. I can't help it. I hesitate behind a tree to watch Rafi fight the demons. Now that I know what to look for, I can tell there are about half a dozen of them. Definitely running on 2 feet. Definitely low to the ground. Not all of uniform size, either. One is at least a foot taller than the shortest one. One seems outright chubby. Their small forms could be human or angel, although they don't move like either. When they go into hyperdrive, their motions are fluid, as though that is their natural pace. These things are definitely not human. Maybe these are some form of nasty angel breed. Aren't cherubs always drawn as children? Rafi catches one as it tries to whiz by him. 2 others had started going for him but stop when they see Rafi slice through the little demon. It screeches something awful as it flails on the forest ground. The others aren't daunted, though, as they dash at Rafi to do their bump-and-run routine and shove him off balance. I figure it won't take long before they start biting or stinging or whatever it is they do.
Rafi, behind you!
I grab the nearest rock and take a heartbeat to aim. I've been known to hit the bullseye playing darts, but I've also been known to miss the dartboard altogether. Missing the dartboard here means hitting Rafi. I hold my breath, take aim at the nearest shadow, and throw with as much force as I can muster. Bullseye! The rock smashes into a shadow, stopping it cold. It's almost funny how the low demon practically flips backward as it falls. Rafi never needs to know that I was aiming for the other one. Rafi swings wildly with his sword, slicing a demon's chest.
I told you to run!
So much for gratitude. I bend and grab another rock. This one is jagged and so big that I can barely lift it. I might be getting greedy, but I lob it at one of the demons anyway. Sure enough, it lands a foot away from the fight. This time, I go for a smaller, more aerodynamic stone. I'm careful to stay out of reach of the fighting circle, and the low demons let me. I guess my stone throwing doesn't even show up on their radar. I take aim at another shadow, then throw with all my might. It hits Rafi on the back. It must have hit him on his wound, because he stumbles forward, staggers 2 steps, then stops just in front of 2 demons. His sword is down, almost low enough to trip him, and he's out of balance as he faces them. I swallow my heart, shoving it from my throat back down into my chest. Rafi manages to lift the sword, but he doesn't have time to stop them from biting him. He cries out. My stomach clenches in sympathetic pain. Then, a strange thing happens. Stranger than what's been happening, that is. The low demons spit and make distinct noises of disgust. They spit as if trying to get the bad taste out of their mouths. I wish I could see what they look like. I'm sure they're making repelled expressions. Rafi cries out again as a 3rd one bites him on his back. He manages to bat it away after a few tries. That one makes a choking noise and spits noisily as well. The shadows back off after that. Then, they melt into the general darkness of the forest. Before I can wrap my mind around what just happened, Rafi does something just as strange. Instead of declaring victory and walking away safe, like any sane survivor, he chases after them into the dark woods.
Rafi!
All I hear are the dying screams of the low demons. The sounds are so eerily human, goosebumps prickle my spine. I suppose all dying animals sound that way. Then, as quickly as it started, the final scream fades into the night. I shiver alone in the dark. I take a couple of steps toward the black woods where Rafi disappeared, then stop. What am I supposed to do now? The wind blows, chilling the sweat on my skin. After a while, even the wind falls quiet and still. I'm not sure if I should run to try to find Rafi, or run away from the whole thing. I remember that I'm supposed to be on my way to Paige, and that keeping myself alive until I rescue her is a good goal. I start to shiver more than the cold calls for. It must be the after effects of the battle. My ears strain to hear something. I take anything, even a grunt of pain from Rafi. At least I'd know he's alive. The wind rustles the tops of the trees and whips my hair. I'm just about to give up and head into the dark trees to look for him when the sound of crunching leaves gets louder. It could be a deer. I take a step back away from the sound. It could be the low demons, back to finish the job. The branches rustle as they part. A Rafi-shaped shadow steps into the clearing. Utter relief washes over me, relaxing muscles I hadn't realized were tense. I run to him. I put my arms out for a big hug, but he takes a step back from me. I'm sure even a man like him, that is to say, a non-man, can take comfort in a hug after a fight for his life, but apparently not for me. I stop just in front of him and drop my arms awkwardly. My delight at seeing him, though, doesn't entirely dry up. So? Did you get them? He nods. Black blood drips off his hair, like he's been sprayed with the stuff. Blood soaks both his arms and stomach. His shirt is torn at the chest, and it looks like he took some damage. I have the impulse to fuss over him, but I hold it in check. Are you all right? It's a stupid question, because there's not much I can do for him if he isn't all right, but it just tumbles out. He snorts.
Aside from being beamed with a rock, I'll live.
Sorry. I feel pretty god-awful about that, but there's no point in groveling over it.
The next time you have a quarrel with me, I'd appreciate it if you could just talk to me first, before resorting to pelting me with rocks.
Oh, all right, I grumble. You're so damn civilized.
Yeah, that's me. Civilized.
He shakes the blood off his hand.
You okay?
I nod. There's no graceful way to step back after my aborted hug attempt, so we stand closer than is comfortable. I guess he thinks so, too, because he slips by me into the clearing. He must have been blocking the wind for me, because I suddenly feel cold when he steps away. He takes a deep breath, as though to clear his head, and lets it out slowly. What the hell were those things? I ask.
I'm not sure.
He wipes his sword on his shirt. They weren't your kind, were they?
No.
He slides his sword back into its sheath. Well, they certainly weren't mine. Is there a third option?
There's always a third option.
Like, freaky evil demons? I mean, even more evil than angels?
Angels aren't evil.
Right. Gee, how could I have forgotten? Oh, wait. Maybe I got my wacky idea from that whole attack and destroy maneuver you guys pulled? He heads back out into the forest, through the far side of the clearing. I hustle after him. Why did you chase those things? I ask. We could have been miles away before they changed their minds and came back for us. He responds without turning around to look at me.
They're too close to something that shouldn't exist. Let something like that get away, and they'll only come back to haunt you. Believe me, I know.
He speeds up. I trot after him, practically clinging to him. I don't want to be left alone in the dark again. He gives me a sidelong glance. Don't even think about it, I say. I'm sticking to you like a wet shirt, at least until daylight. I resist reaching out and grabbing his shirt for guidance in the dark. How'd you get to me so fast? I ask. It must have been seconds from the time I screamed to the time he showed up. He continues to trek through the woods. I open my mouth to repeat the question, but he speaks over me.
I was tracking you.
I stop in surprise. He keeps going, so I run after him, to make sure he's only 2 steps ahead of me. All kinds of questions float in my head, but it's no use asking them all. I keep it simple. Why?
I said I would make sure you got back to camp safely.
I wasn't going back to camp.
I noticed.
You also said that you'd take me to the Aerie. Leaving me alone in the dark was your idea of taking me there?
It was my idea of encouraging you to be sensible and go back to camp. Apparently, sensible is not part of your vocabulary. What are you complaining about anyway? I'm here, aren't I?
It's hard to argue against that. He did save my life. We walk in silence for a while as I chew that over. So, your blood must taste god-awful to ward off those things, I say.
Yes. That was a little weird, wasn't it?
A little weird? That was freaking Bizarroville. He pauses and looks back at me.
Are you speaking English?
I open my mouth to make a smart comeback, but he interrupts.
Let's keep it quiet, shall we? There may be more out there.
That shuts me up. Exhaustion hits me. Probably some kind of post-trauma something or another. I figure having company in the dark, even if it is an angel, is as good as I can hope for tonight. Besides, for the first time since I started this nightmare trek through the woods, I don't have to worry about whether I'm going in the right direction. Rafi walks confidently in a straight line. He never hesitates, subtly adjusting our route here and there to get around some gorge or meadow. I don't question whether he actually knows where he's going. The illusion that he does is enough to comfort me. Maybe angels have a special sense of direction the way birds do. Don't they always know which way to migrate and how to get back to their nest, even if they can't see it? Or maybe that's just my desperation, making up stories to make myself feel better, like a mental version of whistling in the dark. I quickly become hopelessly lost and exhausted to the point of delirium. After hours of trudging through the woods in the dark, I start to wonder if maybe